Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Mark My Words. This is Mark Shaw, and welcome to tonight's episode. I'm actually very excited about tonight's episode. And as many of you may know, this is the month of National Coming Out Day, which is actually on October 11th every year. So this month's shows are dedicated to National Coming Out Day related topics. So tonight, I'm going to talk a little bit and then introduce our guests. So state by state, the nation is doing the right thing, providing marriage equality to all couples, regardless of sex. And this protects many children that are currently being raised by same-sex couples. The American Psychological Association points to the 2000 U.S. Census data that states that 33% of female same-sex couple households and 22% of male same-sex couple households reported at least one child under the age of 18 living in the home. According to the Williams Institute, a national think tank at UCLA Law, as of 2005, an estimated 270,313 children in the United States live in households that are headed by same-sex couples. As marriage equality becomes the law of the land, more and more same-sex couples will be raising children. And more in my own circles, I see younger gays and lesbians currently in their teens and 20s who view their lives as married to their partner with kids. A far cry from the future I envisioned for myself at that age, as is the case for most of my generation. So as I go through life, I meet more and more same-sex couples who are raising families. So one such couple is here with me tonight, George and Farid, who live here in New York. And they're here to share their story and answer your questions. And I'm really happy to have them on my show. I met Farid when he was a student of mine at IPEC, the Institute for Professional Excellence in Coaching, where I teach. And I met his husband, George, shortly after. And I'm really inspired by their relationship, by the raising of their children and their lives together. So we're going to talk tonight about their lives as dads, as well as other interesting parts of their history, both together and apart. So I'm really excited to have you guys here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. It's great, it's great to be on here with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Certainly. Thanks for taking the time to be here and share your story with the world. So, I'm really
the universe,
guys. Here, the universe, exactly, internationally. So I'm just really excited. I mean, you guys have really inspired me with your relationship and just making the commitment to raise two children, and while you've got a full-time business that you're also business partners in, it's just, that's quite a feat, it's quite a challenge, and I'm just really, I just admire it. So I just wanted the world to know your story. And let's begin and talk about this a little bit. How long have you both been together?
We've been together. This is George. Yeah, we've been together since February 2001. So we're going on 12 and a half years since we first met.
Wow.
Yeah.
12 and a half years.
It's like 1,000 years in dog life. So
yeah,
it's a very long time.
I also understand that's like 24 straight years and about 37 lesbian years.
Yeah, something like that.
So, well, very cool. How did you guys meet?
We met at a dating function called Date Bait, held at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center. This is Farid, by the way, in Manhattan. I was at a point where I wanted to be in a relationship, and I had come through a number of dysfunctional relationships, and I'd done a lot of work on myself, and as a result of being in a really, really bad relationship, I took a pause. I took a pause to work on myself, and I decided to try something differently, and I went to this organization called Date Bait. Date Bait. Bait as in hooking a worm on a hook and tossing it out there and see what catches, and that's where George and I met. George, you want to pick it up from
there? Wow.
Yeah. It was a room filled with 100 bachelors. Everyone had a number, and everyone would go around the room with a microphone, stand up, and talk for 60 seconds. If you spoke longer than 60 seconds, you got like a buzzer. You had to wrap up your story and sit down. After about after an hour and a half or so of doing that, then you had some mingle time where you could go around the room. And how it works is, you know, if you like who you met, you put their number down. And if they put your number down, you're a match, and they ask that you at least go on a date. So Fareed picked me, I picked Fareed, and we matched, and we went on a date.
That's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah, I've actually been to Date Bait numerous times, so I'm very familiar with the experience. By the way, just for folks, for clarity, the numbers that you write down that George is talking about, everybody has a name tag with a three-digit number on it, and you're given a Scantron form and a number two pencil, and you put in the three-digit numbers on the Scantron form of all the guys that you'd like to go on a date with, and then they match everybody up. And the really cool thing about it is, if I remember correctly, if you choose somebody and they don't choose you, they don't find out that you chose them, so you don't have the rejection factor of having to at least face the rejection. Of course, you know, if you put down somebody and they don't get a match, you know that they didn't match you, but at least they don't know that you picked them.
Yeah.
So, and I also know that they have a requirement, a minimum requirement that meets the criteria for a date. And if I remember correctly, it has to be one-on-one for 30 minutes, at least 30 minutes in a public place.
That's correct.
And, right? Yeah, and if you stand up your date and you're reported to the date bait police, you're not allowed into future events.
You're banned, yes. You're banned.
Good.
Yeah, our first date, we actually went to an Indian restaurant. I think that's maybe what one of us said during the stand-up portion, and we went to an Indian restaurant for our first date.
Wow. Very cool. So, great. So speaking of restaurants, I know that you guys, of course, are in the business. You own a restaurant. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your restaurant, and then I want to get into what made you decide to open a restaurant. But tell us a little bit about, you know, where it is, what kind of food and all that.
Sure. We own a 120-seat Pan Latin Eatery in Park Slope, Brooklyn. We've been open for 8.5 years now. We have 65 employees, and you know, since we opened our doors back in 2005, we've been very popular. We're very busy on weekends. You know, sometimes guests wait an hour to 2 hours to be seated. It's just been a fantastic business, and you know, the other owner is Fareed, my husband. So it's been an interesting journey, you know, starting a business with your significant other.
But what's great about the restaurant is that, you know, it's Colombian food, by the way, and the name of the restaurant is Bogota Latin Bistro. And a lot of people aren't familiar with Colombian food, but being that I'm part Colombian, my mother's Colombian, I was born in Colombia, I always had an affinity for this food, obviously, and I always knew that, or sense had a very strong feeling that people would love this cuisine, and it wasn't a cuisine that was widely familiar. And George and I took George on a trip to Colombia early on in our dating relationship, and he fell in love with the food, and we both were convinced that this is something that we could spread to a very broad palate out there, and we hit upon a very winning formula, basically. I used to always say, why, if I want really great Latino food, why do I always have to crawl into a hellhole somewhere to get a really great bowl of rice and beans? And granted, we serve a lot more than just rice and beans. It's an awesome, awesome menu, fantastic cuisine, in a wonderful environment, and that was the goal, to elevate the, and that's part of our mission, what we do in terms of the restaurant, to elevate the status and awareness of Latin cuisine.
Yeah, and this is George. I always wanted to open up a restaurant. You know, Fareed wanted nothing to do with the restaurant business in the beginning, and we, you know, we would go on many dates to restaurants, and I would always be, oh, wow, did you see what the server did, or do you see how this bar looks, or this chair, that. You know, we would walk out after our, you know, restaurant date, and I'd see a for rent sign and run to the space to look in, and I've always had dreams of opening up a restaurant. And in the beginning, Fareed would be like, you know, he'd be competing with my attention, you know, in the restaurant, because, you know, he'd want to connect and chat, and I'd be looking at everything behind the scenes going on, and, you know, and that he would at times, you know, just say, hey, listen, I'm on a date, you know, with you. I want you to pay attention to me. And then sure enough, one day, Fadi was like, I know George is going to open up a restaurant. I need to get on board or else, you know, I'm going to miss out. And sure enough, he decided, let's do this together.
That's great. That's really great. And when did you open it?
We opened in 2005, so we had been together 4 years already.
Ah, great. Wow, wonderful. And you have 2 hours sometimes that people wait for seating. That's a wonderful success. Congratulations on that. Good job.
Yeah, thank you.
Well done.
Yeah,
well done.
It still blows my mind. Even 8 years into this, it still blows my mind. People are lining up for
wow.
this. But I shouldn't be surprised because it's testament to the fact that when you really put your passion, your hard work, and dedication, commitment, and discipline into something, there are rewards. And I think that speaks to the relationship as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Which is a good segue right there. So actually what I'll ask you to do is at the end of the show, I'll ask you again for sort of restaurant information if you want to announce that out there so people who are local can go and check it out. And even maybe people who travel to New York would like the wonderful treat of checking it out. So at the end of the show, we'll get more information about that. So great. Excellent. Wonderful. So so let's talk a bit about your family and your relationship. What made you decide to have kids?
This is George speaking. I hit a point where when I turned 32, that's how old my dad was when he had me. And, you know, something inside of me, like my biological clock started ticking. Like, you know, something's missing. You know, I'm in a great relationship. I have a great business. You know, every free moment we get, we're going out to, you know, shows, concerts, dinner. But something was missing, and I wanted, you know, to have kids. And I've always wanted to have kids. I loved being around kids. I was almost a school teacher. And sure enough, I started telling Fareed, like, listen, how would you feel about having kids? How would you feel about having kids? You know, Fareed at first was petrified. You know, and we just started doing research, coming across other gay parents. One of the major influences for us wanting to be fathers was one of our customers. One of our customers had a child that he adopted, and we would see the two dads with the child come in for brunch, and we were like, oh, wow, look, like, they're doing it. You know, we can do it. And then sure enough, they had a second child a few years later. So they had two kids, and we're like, you know what, let's meet up with them. Let's find out how they did it. And, you know, and Fareed eventually came around, you know. Fareed, do you want to add?
Sure. I come from a very, well, not my immediate family, but my mom is one of 12. And my mom is a Colombian. She's Colombian. And whenever I'd go to South America, I'd be surrounded by tons and tons of family, and I would see how much joy these children would bring everyone, pretty much. And coming back here, I just felt that there was something lacking. There was an emptiness, even though as a gay man, I never envisioned that children could be a part of my life. It seemed like the life track for a gay man had been pretty much laid out by the magazines that tell you this is how you're supposed to look. This is where you're supposed to eat. This is what your body should look like. Here's where you work out. Here's how you dress. And here's how much sex you should be having. And pretty much that was what I kind of signed on to. You know, and then as you get older, you kind of like accept the fact that you start getting older and you kind of like fade away, I suppose. And I kind of, you know, so for me, the idea of having children just never was something that I didn't see enough examples of it until George, as he mentioned, there was a couple that came into the restaurant with a child. And I remember the first time I saw them in the restaurant, and George was so excited. And he said to me, oh, look, you have to meet the gentleman at table 50 with his child. That's his baby, and it's a gay couple, and blah, blah, blah. And I remember feeling terrified. It was as if a Martian had landed on this planet for the very first time, and I had no idea how to approach them, what to say, how to act. And I think I stayed away from them for quite some time because I just didn't know how to engage with them. And by the same token, I also know that, you know, George and I are in a relationship, and what's important to him can't be shut down by me. If it's really, really important to him, to some degree, it has to be important to me too, and I really have to honor something that he really, really wanted, even if I wasn't completely on board. And little by little, I started processing what it could look like, what it would mean to be a father. And, you know, the restaurant has been very successful for us, and our life had simply become going out to dinner night after night after night, which over time just became very, very mundane and boring and monotonous. And we both came to the conclusion that there's something missing here. There's got to be something more. As fabulous as it may sound to have money, to go out to eat, to travel wherever you want to, whenever you want to, after a while, it just doesn't appear to be enough. And there definitely was something missing for the two of us. And I came to the conclusion after those numerous trips to Colombia and being around family and children, that might just be the missing piece, children in our lives.
Sure. You know, it's so wonderful to hear how far we've come. I mean, you know, you talked before about what your vision was really for your life after coming out, right? And how it's really changed. I remember coming out, I was 23, you know, and it was, well, I won't say what year it is because then everyone will know how old I am. No, that's fine. I was actually in grad school. Mm. I was 23, so it was, you know, 1988, I think. And so it's just amazing that, yeah, at that time, getting married, having kids, so, like, not on anyone's radar screen. And we've really come a long way from a vision of, you know, a life of just kind of, you know, dating and maybe having a relationship or two, or maybe even, you know, connecting with somebody for life, but not really ever getting married, kids certainly not being a possibility. It was all about who do you come out to and who don't you come out to, and, you know, are you going to lose your job, are you going to lose contact with family members who aren't going to approve, and, you know,
yeah,
and some of that stuff. And then, of course, the bar scene. You know, and it was all about the bar scene, the bar scene, the bar scene, the bar scene. And now here we are with an entirely different vision for our lives and of what's possible. And it's just amazing when I hear younger gay people, teenagers, that come out. And you know, it's funny, they're like, they're not even in the fight for marriage equality rights from the point of view of it's about time we have them. They're in the point of view of, well, what do you mean we can't get married? That's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. You know, they've just grown up into an entirely different world. It's just beyond them. It's unfathomable that we shouldn't be allowed to get married. So it's just really great to hear how that's changed, which is why I just love stories such as yours and where you're headed. So you said, Farid, that you were terrified to meet this couple. So how did it ultimately feel for you when George initially made it clear, like, you know what, I want kids? How'd that feel?
It was a process. It was a process. I really felt that I was going against everything that had been ingrained within me. And it just involved a lot of internalizing of where I want to go in this life and what possibilities are that out there, and also ultimately making my partner happy. You know, this sounds crazy, but I just remember I would walk past as George was planting seeds in my head, and I was already adamant about no, 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 no. I would start to see children on the street differently. I'd start to see parents very differently. I would walk past the streets here in Brooklyn. I'd see discarded old plastic toys and furniture out on the sidewalk ready for pickup by the sanitation department, and thinking, I really have to fight against the notion that that this crap is going to end up in my home one day. You know, I love my home, a place, you know, I've got this motto of a place for everything and everything in its place, and I've taken great pride in creating a beautiful home, but that bringing in children will mean bringing in plastic and bringing in toys and bringing in clutter and whatnot. So that was all part of the process, you know, just looking at the material things that were involved in bringing in a child, let alone a child itself. It's just, you know, it's amazing when I look back. I don't know how I was able to process it and eventually come to terms with the fact that, yes, we're about to change our dynamic completely and turn it upside down as not just two gay guys, but just now two men who are creating a family with children. I can't quite tell you what it was that kind of like flipped the switch for me. But as was the case with the restaurant, George was all about the restaurant in the beginning, and I fought tooth and nail. I had a very comfortable job working in a law firm. I had been there 15 years. I had the benefits. I had the security. I had a semi-decent salary. At some point, I just thought this is not enough, and George planted seeds along the way of what was possible. Maybe it's a, you know, by the way, for the record, I'm 48 and George is 35. So there's a big age difference there. I don't know if that lends itself to explaining who, what, when, where, or how, in terms of what's possible. But I just decided to, once I commit to anything, whatever it is, it was the restaurant. When I decided to commit to the restaurant, I gave myself 100% to the to the idea of creating a successful restaurant. And when it became the situation around family, I decided, you know what? If I'm going to throw myself into this, it'll be 100% and just make the best of it.
Wow. That's really cool. You just kind of threw yourself into it.
And using the restaurant as well as example, as the restaurant has proven itself as a result of me and George both coming together, aligning ourselves in our vision and our passion with let's just make this successful and make it happen. The same thing has come true with the family as well. Once I threw my energy and my passion around what George wanted, in this case a family with children, I got to tell you, Mark, I am... Being a father, especially a father of twins, and especially the father of a boy and a girl, I gotta tell you, it's as a gay man, it is something that is beyond my wildest dreams, and it is something that I don't take for granted. And I have become absolutely in love, not just with these two kids that are about to turn two in November, but I've become really, really in love with my life, and I really, really embrace. If there was any doubt, any confusion around where I was headed, who I was, what I was doing here, the kids have really given me a grounding around which I can just forge ahead in my life, completely proud of who I am and what I'm doing.
That's great. I can hear it as you talk about them, and just even, you know, whenever I talk with you and you talk about the babies, as you refer to them, you know, you light up, you both do. And it's so charming. It's so wonderful. And so that's great. It's really great to hear. It's really, really terrific to hear.
I can't believe that I'm a gay man with children. I am so proud, and I'm ecstatic.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. So when you say, Fadid, that it gives you, that being a father of two children gives you a grounding upon which you can move forward, tell me more about what you mean by that.
You know, I come from a family, a broken family. I come from a broken family. My mom and my dad divorced when I was 3 years old. I'm the oldest of three. And I grew up on welfare, and I grew up in a very middle-class town, but coming from the lower class. My mom on welfare, and I didn't know where my life was headed. I didn't know, I had no direction. My mom had very limited resources to give us, to ground us. And of course, we're the children of immigrants, and the children, with everything that I've learned thus far, the children have given me purpose in life, and it's just so wonderful to not have to subscribe to what I've always believed to be my future for me, which is, again, a life of bars, drinking, picking up men, or ultimately disappearing as an older gay man. Where because I may not have the looks any longer or the body any longer, I'm no longer relevant on the scene, if you will. But the children have given me really great purpose in life, and they've tapped into me, from me, a profoundness of love that I never knew existed. I think it's something that everyone has their own journey in life, but that's been missing for so many gay men. But that so many gay men have also experienced, that when you have children, it's an amazing, amazing vein of love that gets opened up that's unlike anything that anyone's ever experienced.
Yeah, that's what I've heard from every same-sex couple that I know, male or female. I've heard similar experiences, and of course, you know, from every straight couple too. I mean, that's the experience that human beings, regardless, have. When they have kids, for the most part. Certainly there are some sad exceptions out there where it doesn't really go that way and whatnot. But, it's really great to hear that. Something that I want to bring up and ask is, so that each of you I know is biologically related to one of the kids, and the kids are twins. I'm sure listeners are right now having a furrowed brow and a puzzled look on their face going, huh? How can that be? Which was exactly my reaction when you informed me of that. So explain to me how you went about having the kids, and how is it that each of them is biologically related to one of you? George, why don't you take that one?
Sure. Well, we did gestational surrogacy, which means eggs from one woman are planted in another woman and then carried. So the woman carrying the babies and then, you know, giving birth to the baby, she's not biologically tied to the kids. So what Farid and I did is, you know, when we presented with egg donors, you know, we found an egg donor that matched criteria we were looking for. We were looking for two things, height and someone from, you know, Central South America. And once we located an egg donor from there, she was able to produce 20 eggs. What they did in the fertility clinic is they created two piles. 10 eggs were in Farid's pile, 10 eggs were in my pile. And then we fertilized those eggs, and then the doctor picked the best egg from each pile and then planted them into the surrogate. So the kids have the same biological mother, but different fathers. And I'm tied to one kid, and Farid's tied to the other kid. So
and the surrogate is a carrier. So basically, we're talking about two women. It's not just. It sounds very impersonal in a way to talk about an egg donor and a surrogate, but two women. We identified one woman who had the characteristics that we were looking for, as George mentioned. We wanted somebody tall. We wanted somebody from Central South America, and we selected her. She went into they injected her with a bunch of drugs to overstimulate her ovaries to produce her. Numerous eggs, they were able to extract 20 in one shot. They divided those into two piles of 10. Of those 10, they fertilized one pile with George's sperm, one pile with my sperm, and then they found the most viable ones of the two piles, the ones that were most likely to grow.
So did they implant?
And then we found the woman in Colorado.
The other mother?
Yeah, they only implanted two, so we had 100% success rate. You know, there is a chance that only one could take. There is a chance that both could split, and we could have ended up with, you know, quadruplets. You know,
quadruplets.
So we actually were present for the
four.
Exactly. Well, actually, that's the next argument. I want more kids, and Fuddy doesn't. But we can talk about that later. But we were actually present at the 8-week ultrasound. We actually flew, and our surrogate was out west. We flew out west. And at the 8-week sonogram, where you're looking for heartbeats, you know, I was secretly hoping there'd be three heartbeats, you know. But there were two heartbeats, and right there you're like, wow, this is happening. This is happening.
Wow.
And it's just like, oh, my God, you're there in the room with the surrogate, who we have a fantastic relationship, by the way. The egg donor is actually, you know, anonymous. We don't have a relationship with the egg donor. But the surrogate, we were there 8 weeks. We're there in the same room with the doctor. We see the heartbeats. And then actually at the 20-week mark, we flew back out west to find out the sex of the kids. And it was just amazing because, like, you know, to find out we're having a boy and a girl, that's like the perfect package. But, you know, I kept wondering, am I going to have the girl? Am I going to have the boy? Vice versa. And the surrogate, she knew all along. She knew she was carrying a boy and a girl, you know. So,
what was exciting also was the fact that we were in the room as the fertilizer. They're called zygotes at that point. The fertilized zygotes were being implanted. So we were there in the room with her, watching on a monitor. They had a monitor in there as the doctor is kind of inserting these two fertilized eggs in her, and we were witnessing these two little zygotes just floating up into her uterus and implanting themselves. Boom. Right there. That's it, which I think the majority of heterosexual couples never get to see as they're busy conceiving.
Yeah.
It was
quite miraculous. An amazing life experience.
And it was a journey. And let me tell you this, you know, I had some straight girlfriends of mine, and, you know, they took us right to Babies R Us, to, you know, Pottery Barn Kids, just to give us a little schooling on, you know what, you're going to need this, you're going to need this boppy, you're going to need this, you're going to need that. Like, this was a foreign world to us. And, you know, we're there with our little register gun. Let's register this. Let's register that. And you know, as Fadid mentioned, you know, we're kind of minimalist. You know, our apartment is immaculate. You know, we just don't like to buy stuff. And just now to, like, wow, this is a new world. And then we had
How do you have an immaculate apartment with two little children? How do you
It's changed a little. I know. Well, we get rid of a lot of things, or we put.
Well, like,
no,
you know, your toys, you'll get your toys at school. So
or with grandma and grandpa spoil them. We're like, no, you know what? We have enough clothes, or we have enough this. But you know, we actually had this. We went all out for a baby shower. We had a baby shower 2 weeks before the kids were born. You know, we had about 200 close friends come. You know, we had a photographer set up cutouts with Fuddy, myself, and the surrogate. We had a magician. We had, you know, a cartoonist, balloon, and, you know, maker. It was actually a lot of fun, a fortune teller. And we rented out this
We turned it into a huge event, and so many people turned out. We rented out this huge bar music hall in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
It was so much fun, so much fun.
And the highlight of the event was we actually Skyped our surrogate out west. So we Skyped her in, and actually all our guests got to, like, see her and interact with us, and it was fantastic. She got to show the belly, you know, because by then she was already, like, 32, 33 weeks. So it was really cool to just
show
our family and friends that.
And I think one of the things that I loved most about it was the feet. Oh, go ahead.
After the fact,
I heard from so many straight couples and gay men also that it was such an emotional experience, especially for older gay men to witness, that we could gather so many people around this event and celebrate it. That there were people that lost so many friends through the 70s and 80s to AIDS and 90s that never ever envisioned, could never imagine that we would come to a point where two men could be celebrating in conjunction with a few hundred people, gay and straight, the arrival of two children to a gay couple. That was really fascinating.
Yeah.
We heard that from straight people as well. They were so thrilled for us. They were just in awe of seeing gay, straight, black, white, you name it, every shade in between of age, of sexuality, you name it, whatever, all gathered together in celebration of what we were creating. So that was really awesome.
Wow. Wow. That's great. That's great. And by the way, just I'm aware that, you know, because the Blog Talk Radio Network all works over phone lines, there's a bit of a satellite delay, which is why sometimes when one of us interrupts the other, we tend to not hear each other right away and continue to talk over each other. So just in case our listeners are wondering why that's happening, that's a little bit of a technology limitation there. So great. So I'm curious, if only one egg had taken and the other hadn't, and they needed to then go use another egg, would those two children still be considered twins?
I would say no, because they're not born at the same time. I guess
they're not carried at the same time. Yeah,
they're not carried at the same time, but
they would definitely be
brother and sister.
Gotcha.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Great. Okay, very cool.
You're going to see in the future, they're going to, I don't know the actual term for this yet, I don't know if they've come up with a term yet, but you're going to see more and more of this, you know, as more and more same-sex couples have kids.
Sure, I imagine so.
Well, there is a
number.
I remember reading a case recently of a woman who was impregnated by her husband, and, you know, listen, it happens. She was having an affair, and she gave birth to two children. One was black, one is white, both fathered by a black, you know, one fathered by a black man, one fathered by a white man at the same time. There's a term for that. I don't know what that is, but it does happen. It does happen. And in this case, they were also referred to as twins as well.
Wow, very interesting.
Yeah, very.
We're at the 30-minute mark, and I just want to take a little bit of a pause just to announce just to make a couple of announcements. The next three shows that are coming up here on the Life Coach Radio Network, and then we'll get back to Fredeed and George. Before I do that, let me just remind everybody we will be taking your calls. So please feel free to call in with questions. The number to call if you have a question that you'd like to ask Fredeed or George and or George, the number is 646-716-9397. That's 646-716-9397. So we'll be taking your calls just a little bit later on in the call. Announcing the next three shows that are coming up here on the Life Coach Radio Network. So tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. is Frank Talk with David Frank Gomes. And that is Frank Talk is a show about the art and science of a happy, meaningful life. You get some really good pointers there about being happy and meaningful in your life. So I highly recommend that get a listen from you all. After that, on Tuesday at noon, is Fun to Fortune, Entrepreneur Startup Success with Coach Jeff. So callers and guests share their inspiration, their businesses, and what makes their business fabulous, the challenge and obstacles, and what helps them persevere and prosper. So you can listen to them and learn as you go through the startup waters. And then Wednesday at 5:30 is a new show that we have on our network, and it's called Conversations with Authors, and it's the first episode. And the host of that episode will be interviewing notable coaches who have published their philosophies and deepest thoughts. They're live and on the Life Coach Radio Network for the first time on Wednesday at 5:30 to share their wisdom. And the first guest on that show will be Janelle Boer-McCauley. Janelle is the author of Finding Me, which is a chapter in the bestseller Succeeding in Spite of Everything. And she's also a certified psychology coach and the executive managing director of the Phoenix chapter of eWomen Network. So that's Conversations with Authors Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. And then lastly, of course, is my next show, the next episode of Mark My Words, which is actually going to be next week. I mean, usually every 2 weeks we get a little bit of schedule change. So next week, also in honor of National Coming Out Day month, I'm going to be interviewing an amazing man who is also one of my former students at the Institute for Professional Excellence in Coaching, or IPEC, Tony Ferriolo. And Tony is a life coach who coaches transgender teens and their families. The reason why that's Tony's specialty is because Tony himself is a transgender man. So he's going to share his experiences, what he went through throughout his life, being born as he thought, a little girl, and discovering through his life that he was in fact a boy and is now a self-made man, as we call him, which is also the title of the documentary film that was made about his life, which you can actually go see the preview clip for on my website at www.markshaw.com, clicking on the Mark My Words radio tab. So you'll see on the upcoming show, you'll see that, and you can click on the link to watch the trailer for his film, Self-Made Man, which has been at several film festivals around in a lot of places. So coming back to our guests tonight, George and Fareed, so I'm curious how both of your families reacted when you told them that you decided you're going to go ahead and have kids.
Now, this is George. When I first told my family I wanted to have kids, they thought it was silly. They were a little shocked. They were maybe embarrassed. You know what? You work a lot of hours at the restaurant. Why do you want a kid? How are you gonna make time? You know, I just think in their minds, a gay couple raising kids was like so taboo, and like I don't want to be a part of that. It took them, you know, I guess the kids being born, it took that to happen for them to really just snap out of it on my end. And, you know, I got to tell you, I've seen my family more in the last 2 years than I feel like in the last, I'd say the last 15 years. They love my two kids. They come over at least once a week. They love, hanging out with the grandkids, watching them, and they'll be like, okay, we'll watch the kids. You can go, stay at work later, what have you. And it's just amazing to see that turnaround that, my mom and dad had a theory in their mind, their gay son having kids, oh no, what are people going to think? But to actually see living, breathing grandkids, it really changed their perspective to be like, whoa, wait a second, I felt, when I came out to my family, when I was 18, 19 years old, I felt part of what really hurt them, I think, was they were already thinking like, oh, no, we're not going to have grandkids, and I remember in those initial conversations saying, I'll still have kids, I'll adopt, there'll be something, and I think, just holding on to that, fast forward, 18 years later, they now have grandkids, and they're like, wow, what a bonus, they went from having one grandkid to now having three grandkids. And they
went from being disappointed that they'll never have grandchildren to then initially being almost disappointed that they were going to have grandchildren because it wasn't quite what they expected. And then finally, of course, I guess in the end, your grandchildren are your grandchildren.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You know, and in the beginning, of course, there's clashing of like, no, this is how you, this is how I raised you, and this is how you should raise the kids, and, you know, you should feed them this or do this when they cry. You know, there's a lot of back and forth, like, you know what, this is, you know, this is 2012, you know, this was, you know, when they were infants, 2012, not 1970s, you know, things have changed, you know, it was just interesting.
Sure, and I'm imagining even our straight listeners out there are thinking, oh, I can relate on that.
Yeah.
So, very cool.
Yeah, I think in my case with my mother, it just, you know, coming out as a gay man, informing the world that your family, you're having children, especially if your family has kind of bought into the idea or is in denial, even though it's so apparent that your child is gay, you can't, there's no question around the fact that your child is gay, but I think some parents, some families still try and minimize or hide the fact. But bringing children into the world really means that everybody has to come out. There's no lying. Okay, here's my son. He doesn't have a wife. He doesn't have a man. He doesn't have a wife. He doesn't have a woman. He's not married, blah, blah, blah. But yet he's bringing children into the world, and this is his friend. Now, what does that mean? So that involves another layer of the parents, the family members, having to disclose to their friends, their family, where these children came from and what this means. Yes, it means that my child is gay. I think that that proved very, very difficult for my mom also. She asked me to keep it very quiet in the initial stages of the pregnancy. Well, let's not talk about this until we get there. Get there. I'm not quite sure what she meant by that, even though I was already sharing this with the bulk of my cousins, and they were already so excited for me. My mom, being in her 70s, it was still very, very uncomfortable for her. But as George has said, as was the case with his parents, my mom has come to embrace the kids. And I'm still not quite sure if that has meant that a complete acceptance, that my son is gay, he's happy, he's married, and this is his life, versus maybe some things will change one day, who knows. But you can't take away the fact that she absolutely loves the grandkids.
Yeah, that's great. That's really great. So, another question I have that I'm wondering about, George, you told me once that before you guys committed to one another and began your relationship, you said that he broke your heart a few times. How?
The first year, you know, was really hard. You know, Fareed. You know, Fareed was encouraged to go to date bait, you know, to try new things by his therapist and, you know, give it another shot to get in the dating pool. You know, Fareed had been hurt before, so he wasn't really ready to put the pedal to the metal. You know, I had only been in one relationship. I was in my, you know, early to mid-20s. You know, I just wanted to meet someone and start dating and call someone my boyfriend. And Fareed and I were not aligned, you know, the first year, you know, 2001. And, you know, there was just a lot of back and forth where, you know, even to, you know, be intimate with each other, I think that took a good month and a half to 2 months. And there was frustration on my part with that, too. But, you know, we would hit certain rocks, and then Fareed would be like, you know what, the relationship, I don't think this is for me, let's move on. And, you know, it happened about 3 or 4 times the first year. And it wasn't until, you know, finally, like, I was fed up. By the fourth time, I'm like, I was tired of, like, you know, being pulled around, jerked around left and right, that I was like, you know what, this is not going to work out. We can just be friends or whatever. You know, let me move on. And I actually, I remember it was Christmas 2001, and I booked a trip to Brazil with some friends of mine. And it was that time apart that we missed each other. You know, and it was on that trip that I was like, well, you know, I really miss Fareed. I could see, you know, him being the one for me. And it turns out he was thinking the same thing, you know. So I came back from that trip early 2002, and that's when we decided to commit to each other. So, you know, but yeah, it really was a tough year, you know. And, you know, I guess it can't always be busy. It can't always be easy in the beginning. You know, they say when you work harder for things, you know, the payoff is a lot bigger. And I think that's the case with our relationship.
Sure, absolutely. Fareed, what was it like at your end during those times that George spoke of?
A little background on me. I was the type where, you know, I was someone that had a lot of insecurity, a hell of a lot of low self-esteem. And I was at a point where, not even at a point, but this was my history. Anytime I had the opportunity to land a relationship, I would grab onto it no matter how wrong it might be for me, no matter how dysfunctional, no matter how abusive it might be for me. I come from a very poor family where my mom and dad were divorced when I was 3 years old. And even though my mom and dad were divorced when I was three, my mom still kept trying to wrangle my dad back into supporting, loving, nurturing this, that, you're not doing this, you're not doing this, rather than teach us all to, you know what, it didn't work out, you got to let go and move on. And so it's kind of like what I learned from her. You land a relationship and you hold on to it no matter how wild the ride, how crazy and how insane the ride. And I got to tell you, the ride was always very, very tumultuous, very abusive, and I would always end up in a lot of pain at the end of it. When it came to finally meeting George, when I got to the point where I was meeting George, I had been through a number of dysfunctional relationships. I was in therapy at the time for the first time in my life, and what I decided to do was rather than, you know what, day one, I meet you, I like you, I sleep with you, and we're married, we're going to slow it down. I'm going to slow it down. And what I'm going to do differently this time is, you know what, thank you very much. Not even have sex the first time, you know, the first night. I'm not even going to have sex until who knows when. I'm going to hang out with you a few times, and I will actually encourage you to go out there and keep meeting more guys, as I will do the same as well. So I was in no rush. I really, for me, my relationship, my dating experience with George is more of an experiment in trying different things and seeing what happened at the end of it all. And I was prepared to, you know what, if it didn't work out with George, I would just keep meeting more guys in a different light, other than going to a bar, standing under the appropriate, right, perfect lighting with a drink in my hand, hoping that Mr. Wright would end up discovering me. So it was very painful for George because it seemed to me that he was very definite on finding somebody that he can settle down with. I was definite on experimenting and trying different things and not landing and getting involved in any relationships, just basically trying different ways of meeting people without what I was used to, which is basically an environment of alcohol and sex, and then hoping that it would work out. And ultimately, George kept showing up, and my therapist kept pointing out, this guy keeps showing up, and he keeps showing up, and he keeps showing up, and it seems to me, meaning him, the therapist, this is very different from what you're doing. So I attribute the fact that I finally settled in with George to my therapist, who was a very, very influential at the time, in getting me to try different things and testing and measuring what could work, versus in the past when, as I said, drinking, drugging, and sexing.
Sure. So
and then hoping that would land a wonderful relationship.
Some of that time period.
Sure. Sure.
So obviously your life looks very, very different now than it did at that time. You mentioned earlier, you know, at a time when you were working in the law firm, while you had job stability, you know, other things were pretty difficult at that time for you. And you're mentioning now how that involved, you know, drinking and drugging and clubbing. So you had a lot going on at that time. It sounds like it was a pretty dark time for you before George came along into your life.
It was a very dark time in my life. I wasn't quite sure where I was headed. And you know what? I think for myself, I can only speak for myself, all that putting myself out there and the constant rejection only reaffirmed for me, as I mentioned earlier. I come from a broken home. My mom raised us on welfare. Didn't speak the language. I was a child of immigrants. All that rejection, putting myself out there, I was either hot or not hot. I was either wanted or not wanted. It just perpetuated. It kind of solidified what I believed to be the truth about myself, which is that I wasn't worthy. And that kind of like spread itself across all areas of my life. I wasn't worthy for a great relationship. I wasn't worthy for a great job. I wasn't worthy just for even life itself. I was just somehow I was born. And I had to kind of like deal with the fact that I was born and just struggle ahead and try and find a way to forge through and make it through the day, make it through my life, make it through my skin. It wasn't a very, very happy time in my life. And again, my life had, you know, I don't want to, you know, this magazine is no longer around anymore. For anybody who's gay out there, you might be familiar with the magazine HX. And my life was lived and dictated by the pages of what HX said I should be and where I should go and what I should be doing. And it was pretty, it became a very, very small world. And I knew that no matter how much this magazine or how much the gay culture at that time said, this is who you are and this is how you celebrate life, something just did not fit and feel right for me. And I just kept trying to force myself into that hole, if you will, just trying to fit in and feel happy about, you know, I'm so happy to be gay. And I just wasn't happy to be gay because the environment didn't support the kind of happiness that I was looking for at that time. I was just very, very unhappy. Yeah. I was very unhappy.
There wasn't a lot of gay pride going on for you.
Oh, no, not at all. And I couldn't quite understand. I go to the gay parade and I see half-naked men on trucks, you know, waving and dancing, and I cannot relate to this whatsoever.
Yeah.
And there was a place for me, but it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it sounds like you were on a pretty self-destructive path.
Well, I was on a very self-destructive path.
Yeah.
Definitely. I didn't know what other kind of lifestyle was out there for me. Certainly, the world at large didn't support homosexuality. You didn't see what you see today with the marriage equality happening, support for gay parents, just more openness, even just across the board. You didn't see that back then. I was on a very self-destructive path. I just didn't think there was an out for me. Very, very unhappy.
Yeah.
Very unhappy.
And what work did you do that ultimately led to you loving, respecting, and valuing yourself? I know that you said you worked with a therapist. What was the awakening process, if you will, like for you? And how long did you say that took?
It took, you know, this was, you know, I think my big wake-up call occurred in 1997, where I was at a point where I was so unhappy where my life had brought me, even to the point where I just wanted to commit suicide. I was so unhappy with my life. Every day was a struggle for me to continue on with another day. Every time I'd open up my eyes, every brand new day was like, oh, no, I can't believe I've been given another day to suffer this much through my life. And it just seemed to me that, strangely enough, at that point in time, that messages and messengers just appeared out of nowhere. And they might have always been there. I just wasn't cognizant of it or ready for it. But all of a sudden, people out of nowhere started appearing, saying, you know what, you should speak to this person. You should go here. You should do that. And that included, number one, seeing a therapist, which, you know, I always thought therapists were for crazy people. And you know what? I stepped into a therapist's office, and I spent 4 years in therapy, and it completely, completely changed my life. In addition to that, I started meeting people who were meditating, people that were chanting, people that were going to ashrams in upstate New York. I started jumping around from church to church to church. I was raised in the Catholic religion, which taught me that I was going to hell as a result of being gay. And that was my predominant message, is that no matter how good I am, no matter how nice I am, no matter how kind and generous I am going to hell. And I carried that with me around me like a very dark cloud. And I started church hopping, trying to find a message that resonated with me. And ultimately, through the result of that, the chanting, the meditation, finding different people across my path, I kind of summarize it this way. In the past, I would say yes to all the things that were wrong for me, that were causing me pain, because it was what I was familiar with, and I would say no to anything that was unfamiliar to me, which by and large would be things that were healthy for me, and I decided to switch it. I was going to start saying no to everything that I would say yes to, and start saying yes to everything that I would normally start saying no to, and see what happened. And I started discovering really, really wonderful people, places, and things that I never knew existed because I was so entrenched with the gay lifestyle as it was handed to me. So that was back in 1997 that I said just completely changed my life around. And when I say completely, I mean completely. I just stopped going out, and I started to just become comfortable with being alone and being alone with silence and seeing what it was like to be with myself rather than continuous stimulants, whether they were external stimulants or stimulants such as drugs and alcohol, to change my reality.
Sure. Sure. Well, to change your reality, to numb the pain, you know, I imagine, and which, you know, when we get into addictive behavior like that is ultimately, you know, what that's all about. And it sounds like there was a lot of pain to numb, you know. So I'm interested, George, in how does it feel for you to hear your husband talk about his past when it includes these kinds of stories?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely, you know, scary. You know, I'm glad I met him at the right time. You know, I'm sure if I met him, you know, before 2001, you know, when he was going through that, it would have been a different outcome. You know, but I think it's definitely has shaped him to, you know, the amazing person he is today.
Great. And how does it feel when you think about, you know, sometime down the road, I imagine your kids are one day likely to listen to the recording of this episode. I don't know, just what are your thoughts about that?
I think, you know, hey, not everyone's perfect. And, you know, people, you know, they have to live life. I just think, you know, Fadi'd lived just a different kind of life than I lived and most people lived. But it's just, you know, you go down different paths, you come across different things, and, you know, that saying, what doesn't hurt you or kill you just makes you stronger. And, you know, I'm just thankful that, you know, Fadi'd, you know, learned and grew from that and, you know, doesn't go back. You know, he's been very consistent the last 13 years. But my message to the kids would be like, you know, life's tough, you know, but you got to make the best of it and you learn from your mistakes and you move forward. You know, but yeah,
yeah.
I think what could easily come up years ago is like, oh, I'd be embarrassed or I'd be shame, you know, and there'd be shame in the family. But no, not at all. You know, actions, you know, definitely demonstrate. You know, and then the kids, they're gonna, you know, I mean, they love, you know, they're, well, Fadi's papi and I'm daddy. They love their papi. You know, they're only going to love him more and more as they're able to communicate, you know, and share their words and their thoughts.
Sure. You know, Mark, I'm not ashamed of my story, and it's something, as a matter of fact, that I want my kids to know. I want them to know who their dad was and what I've been through to get to where I am, to be able to bring them into the world and become the man and the father and the husband that I am today. I know very little about my own parents' story, and I don't know how many people truly, truly know anything about their parents other than, my mom worked here and my dad worked there. My mom came from this country, my dad came from that country. I know very little about even my own parents. I think I once asked my mom to tell me something. It's such a weird subject to broach for me even. I said, can you tell me something about what it was like when you and my dad dated, which I have very little knowledge of? Was he a great boyfriend? Did you love him? And she just giggled and said to me, why do you want to know that? I said, I'm just curious. And she said to me, well, he was a traveling merchant, not selling fabric door to door and clothing door to door. And he used to hit on my, you know, the knock on my door often. And he used to tell me that I was really pretty, and but I was really dumb, and that I would never find anyone that would love her, and that she should marry him. And she married him because he conveyed and he kind of expressed a belief that she had about herself that she was dumb. And I thought, I said, did he ever take you anywhere on a date, this or that? She said, I think he took me to the park once. And I remember being so struck by that, like, wow, that's really interesting, and that was insightful, and how sad that is. Whereas with my kids, I want my kids to know everything about me so that it gives them a history, it gives them richness, it gives them a really great foundation upon which to know where they came from and what their dad, what their papi did to get here, to become the man that he is today. I have absolutely no shame in my story, and I want my kids to know my story.
That's great. It's great to hear. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I have another friend who also has a battle with drug addiction in her past. And, you know, her son knows about all that, or knew about all that, I should say, back at, I mean, he still knows, but back when I first connected with them, he was 10 years old, and he knew and understood. She also has, you know, no regrets at all about him knowing that, and feels it's very important for him to actually understand those kinds of struggles and what they're about. So what you're saying makes total sense to me, and is certainly not unfamiliar. And I'm sure actually even, you know, any of our listeners out there who may have struggled with similar pasts may also feel the same way. And speaking of our other listeners out there, again, the number to call in if you have any questions that you'd like to ask, we still have a little bit of time left, 646-716-9397, 646-716-9397, if you'd like to call and ask a question of George and Fareed. So I would like to ask each of you guys, let's start with you, Fareed. What are you most proud of in your life?
I think the thing I'm most proud of in my life is the fact that I just feel like I'm living at the right point in time right now. I'm so proud of the fact that I'm a married gay man with two children. I have a family. I have a family that's recognized by the state, and I took actions to perpetuate that. I'm just so proud to be a husband. I'm proud to be a business owner, and the thing I'm most proudest of is the fact that, you know, maybe second to the fact that I'm out. I'm just so proud to be out and not ashamed of who I am any longer, and living a lie and lying to people and compartmentalizing different components of my life. That, Mark, I think that's probably the answer. I'm so proud to be out. I don't lie to anyone anymore. I'm very transparent, and I'm just so proud to be and accept who I am today.
That's great. So the honesty and authenticity that's in your life now versus earlier is what you're really most proud of, and what you value and cherish.
And the fact, Mark, that I can, you know what, if you like me, great, and if you got a problem with me, that's okay too. I understand that.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Great. Great.
Doesn't mean I have
to
hate
you. What are you?
I think for me, for me, very similar, but, you know, from day one, I knew I was different. I didn't really, you know, relate to the other, you know, kids at school, and, you know, I just knew I was different. You know, I came from two different backgrounds. I was the darkest one in my family. I'm half Greek, half Costa Rican, and, you know, I just, you know, then when I knew I was gay, I'm like, wow, I'm even more different, and I just didn't listen to the naysayers. You know, I just really followed my mind and my heart. You know, and I learned that a lot from my parents who migrated to this country, that, you know, this is the land of dreams, where dreams, you know, come true. And, you know, I just set out to go to college in New York City. I set out to travel the world, to live in Japan. You know, I met Fareed. I didn't give up on that. I really wanted to make that happen. I really wanted to open up a restaurant. I learned how to do that, made that happen. And then, you know, having kids, I just did not let anything steer me the other, you know, other way. I just really stayed true to myself. And you know what? If life is what you make of it, and you know, if you want to make stuff happen, you just got to do it. And I'd say I'm just really proud of that. And today, I'm just, you know, I love the fact that Fareed's in my life, Fareed's my husband, that I have one restaurant under my belt, and I have two kids. You know, and I'm 37 years old. You know, it's amazing to think, you know, if I, you know, what the next 10 years are going to bring, you know, hey, the next 20, you know, and just really keep on going for your dreams. You know, I think Madonna said it early on, and it struck with me in one of her songs, but no risk, no glory. And, you know, you just got to take risks and do it. And, you know, it's easy to be scared and not do anything. And that's something I really try to overpower on a daily, you know, overcome on a daily basis.
Sure, sure. I love how we're, you know, while we're making the effort of busting through stereotypes of gay men here, you go ahead and blow it all by quoting Madonna. Wanted to quote Cher, too, while we're at it. No, that's great.
I was just thinking Cher. You know, she's on her comeback tour again. She every time she goes out, it's her last tour, and she's coming back again. So.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. She's like a boomerang. She just keeps coming back.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's interesting. Jay Leno was talking a couple of weeks ago about, you know, the horrible, horrible circumstances over in Russia right now with Putin's laws that are just completely, you know, victimizing gay men and lesbians and whatnot, and the controversy regarding the Olympic Games as well, and how Cher turned down the opportunity to perform at the Olympic Games because it's not a safe place for LGBT people. So Jay Leno made the joke. He says, in fact, it is so bad over there that just being at a Cher concert is enough to get you arrested for being gay. Great. So while we don't have any callers calling in, I do have a question that has come in as a private message from the chat room that we have online on the Blog Talk Radio interface. And that question is, what's the biggest learning you've received from your relationship and your kids, if you had to name just one?
Wow.
Good question, whoever that is.
I'd say for me is that, you know, it's not always going to be perfect. There's going to be ups and downs, you know, as in life, and, you know, you just have to work through them. And, you know, and admit, you know, if I'm wrong, hey, you know, I'm sorry, I'm wrong, you know, I'm sorry I said that, I didn't mean that. You know, vice versa, we're both going to make mistakes, but, you know, we just have to, you know, forgive each other and move through it. And, you know, when we're united, we are so powerful and we're living life and we love life. But, you know, when we're not aligned and, you know, we're arguing, it's not, you know, nothing good comes out of that. And a lot of times you just have to swallow your pride and say, you know what? Is this in line with how my partner feels? And, you know, I would say that's what I've learned, you know, compromise.
Right. Great.
I think
great.
For me, just basically, ask for help. You know, I'm determined to make this succeed. And, you know, we've been in this together for 13 years. Our kids are going on 2. Our restaurant's going on 8 years. I could have easily thrown it all away day one, year one, you know, and there are still moments where things just feel like I just want to throw in the towel and get the hell out of here. But I'm very optimistic, and asking for help has been crucial for that. I do want to, you are a coach, Mark, and I do want to mention the fact that you've been our relationship coach, and that's in line with asking for help, that we may not necessarily know or have the best tools at hand to communicate with each other to continue moving forward, but there are people out there that can help us, and I do want to mention the fact that you've been very instrumental in getting us even closer in our alignment towards our vision and our future together and with the tools and the skill set that you bring. So asking for help when things seem bleak and you don't know where to turn or what to do when you feel like throwing in the towel. That there's always hope and there's always help.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for that acknowledgement. I really appreciate it. And I really love working with you guys. And, you know, there's just something really huge at stake in that work. And that is you've got 2 beautiful children who rely on their 2 parents to love each other and be good role models for them as far as what a loving relationship is. So there's a lot at stake when we're sitting there for that hour together. So thank you for that acknowledgement. I really appreciate that very much. So great. So tell us a little bit about, as we wrap, the where's your restaurant? And if you can give us its name and stuff, and tell people to pop in and say hi and enjoy an amazing meal, which, by the way, I have yet to do myself. Fri gave out gift certificates to everybody in his iPEC class. And so I still have mine sitting on my desk. So I do intend on coming in, but I just know the food is awesome, and I can't wait to do that. So for our listeners, how can they find you?
Sure. Our restaurant is Bogota, like the capital of Colombia, Bogota Latin Bistro, located at 141 Fifth Avenue in Park Slope, Brooklyn. We are just blocks away from the Barclays Center, and pretty much you can take any train there. And on the web, we're at BogotaBistro.com.
Great. So that's Bogota Latin Bistro, you said?
Correct, yes.
Great. But it's BogotaBistro.com is the website.
Is the website. And we're actually hard at work finalizing a lease for our second restaurant. So so things are going to go.
Great.
We're going to add more to the family.
Yeah, more to the family. And just to let our gay brothers and sisters know that whatever you set your mind to, you can create. And yes, we can, and yes, we are.
Uh-huh.
We're doing
great.
Our thing. So.
Doing
my God,
okay.
Another restaurant, more kids. Like, you know, what are you, Superman?
I know.
You know, we've got how many frozen embryos in the can, George? We've got 11.
Actually, we have. You know, the egg donor was able to produce 20 eggs, and you know, a few of them didn't make it initially. So, and the two were planted were successful. So, I believe we have 13 left
Great.
That are frozen. So
wow!
If we hit the lotto, well, you know, we'll have 13 more kids.
That's great. And actually, we do have a caller that just dialed in. So I'm going to go ahead and pick him up and hear what the question is. So, caller whose phone number ends in 3185, you're on the air. What's your question?
Hi, this is Heidi Krantz, and I am a life coach as well. Very well mentored by Mark Stahl. How are you?
Hi.
Good.
Hey, Heidi.
So I'm really enjoying the show. I tuned in a little bit late, so forgive me if I'm asking something that you have already answered. I'm loving your story and thinking that your story is so unique and so special, but yet in the end, you're two parents with work and kids. And my question is basically, how do you keep the magic in the relationship? How do you keep things from getting mundane and drudgery? What do you do that's special to keep that spark ignited?
That's a fantastic question, Heidi. I'd say, this is George speaking, I'd say you really have to make sure that the relationship comes first. That's advice I got early on from one of my uncles, that the relationship needs to come first. Fadid and I have two scheduled date nights, on a weekly basis that, let's say if something comes up and I need to take a class or something, but at least we're meeting once or twice a week where it's just us, we're going out on the town, whether it's a walk or a show or dinner, where we're just focusing on us.
Fantastic.
Not to mention tech-free Mondays, which is the suggestion that Mark gave us.
Yeah, tech-free Monday, so no TV, no iPad, no phone, gets shut off once we're home from work, once the kids are in bed. So we are forced to just look at each other in bed and see
wow.
what happens.
Wow, you courageous, brave souls.
I know. The only exception is if the restaurant happens to call, then we can break tech-free Mondays because it may be an emergency, but... I think just really you have to set it around time because it's so easy to get caught up into work and into the kids and, you know, you just wind up building resentment and this and that. But, you know, the story, it takes a village, you know. My mom and dad help. We do have a great nanny. You know, we have daycare now and it just allows us. And we have managers running the restaurant. So, you know, we're able to just enjoy like a date night a week.
And you know, Heidi, it's really important also for us, at least for me, not to take this relationship for granted. Just because it's, you know, signed, sealed, delivered, we signed on the dotted line, we're married, we've got kids, we've got the home, that doesn't mean that I should take any of that for granted. It means I still need to put in the amount of work, the attention, the awareness, the passion, and the discipline to continue to make sure that this thing grows in the same way that I put that kind of effort into my children and my business. I can't let my relationship default through lack of attention. I need to make sure that I'm available, I'm present, I'm energetic, and I'm passionate, and I bring things to George's attention where, you know what, this needs a little more focus. I need a little more intimacy, I need a little more affection, I need this and I need that, and what do you need as well, so that it's given as much energy as all the other things that are going on in our life as well. I cannot let this relationship, I won't take it for granted as well, because this is what fuels everything else. Without this relationship as being strong and being the foundation, the children will suffer, the family will suffer, the business will suffer, I will suffer, the relationships will suffer. So the relationship is the foundation upon which everything else grows upon, and it needs to be firm and it needs to be given its due attention as well.
Yeah, you need to keep watering the tree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much. Beautiful, inspiring answers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi.
Great. Heidi, great to hear you. Thanks for calling in. I appreciate the call and the question.
Okay, my pleasure.
Okay. So, great. So as we wrap, I just want to thank you so much for being here tonight and for being so open and vulnerable and sharing your story with us. It's just been really it's really been a pleasure, and I love working with you guys, and I really hope that our guests have taken away a lot of inspiration this evening. So you know, for people who don't even quite understand how a same-sex relationship can work. I hope that it's inspired them. And then for same-sex couples out there or LGBT individuals out there who are just having questions and wondering about themselves and their own relationships, I really hope that that they too have taken inspiration from you guys. So it's been really, really great. So any final thoughts from either of you before I give my closing?
I say for me, for George, you know, hey, if I can do it, you can do it, just don't give up. You know, there were times, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, I wasn't dating anyone, and, you know, you don't quit before the miracle happens, they say, and, you know, just run with it. We all can make it happen, you know, and don't let society tell you how you should live your life.
Yeah, and that may be easier said than done, and this is funny, but being that this is National Coming Out Month, I really want to encourage those people that are still living, and granted, it may not be as easy in smaller, closed-minded communities as it is in New York City, but, you know, take the action, let go of the results. Ultimately, you got one life to live, and you got to make it the best. And you should be happy as you go along your journey. And take the action, let go of the result. Let the people that are going to be drawn to you because of who you are be drawn to you. And let those people that will make their exit as a result of you being authentic and who you are make their exit, because they're filling up space in your life that could be filled by people that really want to get to know you and will support you in being who you are. Life is too short to play small.
Great.
Play big, think big, act big. Be big. It can be really, really wonderful once you allow yourself to embrace who you are and what you're meant to be in this world.
Wonderful. Very good words. And I could not agree more. So thank you both again so, so much. And as I wrap it up, I'd just like to invite listeners to feel free to mark your words if you like. So if you have feedback for us that you'd like to communicate to the Life Coach Radio Network, you can visit us at www.blogtalkradio.com/Life Coach Radio Network. And then you click on the follow button and you can send us a message. For feedback directly to me or to suggest a show topic, go to www.markshall.com and fill out the contact form. That's markshall.com, MarkShall.com. Just fill out the contact form. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And we'd love to hear what you want to hear me talk about. So I really hope you all enjoyed the past hour. I certainly did, and that you found it engaging, enlightening, and stimulating. I look forward to speaking with you all again next week as I interview self-made man Tony Ferriello, and I'm really looking forward to that. So thank you again for listening to Mark My Words. I'm Mark, and those are my words. Good night.